This is Gregory Samantha Rosenthal. I'm here with Maya Reed. We're at the Roanoke Public Library, the downtown branch at Elmwood Park. It's October 21st, 2019, and this is an interview for the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ plus History Project Oral History Initiative. Thank you, Maya, for being with us.
Absolutely.
So we want to start with your childhood. Where did you grow up? And what was that like?
I grew up in what is known as Southside, Virginia, which, if you drew a line straight down from Richmond and hit the North Carolina line, that's where I was born. I grew up outside of a little town called La Crosse. I mean, little town, 700 population. And I lived in a little community that was straight out of the 19th century, called Moringo. There was a famous battle that Napoleon had in Moringo in Italy, and for some curious reason, they named this little stop along the road Moringo. it was a good place to grow up. It was a very gentle, secure, protective place until I came out, and then, you know, that story. So, but it was very wonderful growing up. I had a lot of neighbors who were very warm and parenting to me, you know, not disciplining, just watching out and encouraging and being very nice to me. I went, there's a whole history that involves a topic that's very little researched. There's a lot of discussion about child abuse and child sexuality. Not much written about child sexuality. But there was just an incredible underground, sexual underground, in this very remote little community. I was aware of a lot that was going on just from my own experience and the children that I knew, their experience, and they would talk and gossip and what have you. But that's too much to get into. But I'd like to see more research done on that, though that's, it'd be extremely difficult to get people to open up mm-hmm. about.
Are you saying that you were aware from a pretty young age of homosexual activity?
Yeah, that was what I had. And I had a boyfriend once in Phoenix who laughingly used to say that he was 8 before he was 7.
I don't know what that means.
He was 8. He had had oral sex before he was 7. And so that's, I was seduced early on by a guy who lived behind us, and his uncle had been abusing him, I guarantee I knew it. He didn't, never said that outright, but at 1 plus 1, I knew what was going on. And then later on, that was when I was, I guess, about 7 or 8. And then later on, there was a guy who moved into the neighborhood, the basketball player at the high school that we were in. And he seduced me. And I don't know how much frankness you want. Do you want any frankness?
It's your level of comfort.
Oh, okay. Well, he was, he's now dead. Both of them are dead, curiously. And this guy had been having sex up in the town of La Crosse with buddies there, came down, he missed his buddy, so to speak, and so he kind of introduced me, and he introduced me to a broader range of sexuality than it had. To be frank, he wanted to be screwed. He was like, at the time, 12, 13, And he was already very familiar with that. Strangely, he had never heard of lubricants. Anyway, so for about 4 years, we were almost daily had sex.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is, you were in elementary school?
We didn't have a middle school where we were. It was like late elementary school. I was maybe seventh grade through sophomore year. So that was my introduction to being, the word gay wasn't used.
Right. I imagine that none of this world was people who identify as gay.
Oh, heavens no. Yeah. Once I suggested to him that I might want to give him a blowjob, and he said, oh, he was horrified. He says, oh, no, only queers do that. Mm-hmm. Goodness, I've been screwing you for years now, you know. But that was not something he'd ever heard about, being queer.
Let me ask you also about your school and your community at that time. Was it segregated? This was in the 50s?
Completely segregated. All the schools I went through were segregated, even undergraduate school. There were only very, very few black people. Yeah.
And your family, I'm imagining the experiences you had, you were very tight-lipped about at the time.
Oh, yeah. There's no one to talk about. Yeah. Talk to about it.
What about girlfriends? Did you feel an expectation?
My mother did. My mother felt an expectation. And I think she sensed early on that I was different and going to be queer. At 12 years old, she gave me a shotgun for Christmas, and I was furious. I knew exactly what that meant. That meant straighten up. Even at 12, that was very clear to me. I understood what she was doing. And she, in seventh grade, there was like some little seventh grade prom at the end of the year, and she lined up some girl for me to take, and took me there, and blah blah, you know. So, but I resisted. My father never really intervened in those ways, and was protective of me, I think. I don't know if he's long dead. I'm pretty certain he was sexually abused as a boy with a man, by a man. That was a man who owned significant land where they were. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Never talked about, goodness, you couldn't open up that conversation.
Was he masculine?
No, he was a gentle man, and I mean that in a very true way. Kind of soft-spoken, and very polite, and in a true way, a gentle man. He ran a, what was called at the time, a country store, and it was the country store in the area. And as a kid, I started working there when I was at least 11 years old. And I really kind of liked the experience. I liked the jobs I had, like placing items on the shelves when the delivery trucks would come, and they would put them out in the back area. And then I would have the job, generally on Wednesday evening afternoons, placing those cans and whatever else on the shelf. I got the strangest kind of satisfaction out of that, the organizing, having the straight lines. So I have always had a merchant side of my experience. You know, my career is really academic, but I was a merchant as well, I can tell you about that. But I'm going, this is what my does, he ranges.
So let me ask you, just before before we kind of finish childhood. So, in,
oh, we're finished with childhood.
Well, we want to move on. We want to get to grown up too. But it, so, when you were in high school, you know, finishing up high school, are you saying that you didn't really date anyone then? You didn't date girls, and you certainly didn't date.
No, the one girl that I asked to both proms, junior senior proms, turned out to be a lesbian. Surprise, surprise, birds of a feather. We know that story.
Did you? What do you remember about what you thought about your identity at the time? Was it? Did you have any way to map that, any terms? Or you just thought, gee, I'm different, I wish I liked girls? Or, like, how did it feel at that time?
It's hard to remember those things. When I was chairing the sociology department at Radford, that's getting way ahead of the story, I interviewed a guy named Rick Troughton, who was also being interviewed at Miami of Ohio. And he was doing, had done his dissertation and was going to publish it as a book form on coming out. And I almost could recall the name of the book, but I can't right now. And he used the phrase to characterize what people did when they were acting gay but not out. And he said, you would bracket that experience in consciousness. It was over here, you didn't probably label it, and it was protective not to label it. It's like the buddy who, you know, wanted to be screwed, but he couldn't identify with the term queer.
Yeah. So then you went to college in the late 60s, so what was happening there?
Someone was watching over me because I went to William Mary undergraduate.
Okay.
And the guy who I was assigned as a roommate with was gay. He wasn't out. He was in the same kind of position. But, you know, there was a recognition of familiarity there. And his closest friend, named Rick, still is a great friend of mine today. He lives in Palm Springs, comes over to Phoenix to visit every so often, and I really love the man. And there developed a friendship of about eight people, and all but one of them, he was suspect, turned out to be queer. And
so you kind of knew it, but you didn't name it? Or did you name it at the time?
No. I certainly knew the name by that point. I think you could find the word in the general press more often. I remember in high school going to the library and sneakily looking up the word homosexuality in a dictionary. So I had somehow come across that term. That was in, like, junior in high school.
You graduated, what year did you graduate?
69.
Okay.
I graduated from 69 from William & Mary. I graduated 65 in high school.
Yeah. So then what was the next step for you?
What, after the
After William & Mary.
Oh, I went to, I started fishing, you know, for graduate school money. And at that time, boy, was it plentiful. You know, it's amazing to me how people have to borrow so much money to go to graduate school. There was like, I got a National Defense Fellowship I applied to Vanderbilt and Tulane and a number of other places. Well, Tulane offered me the most, and wowee, that's New Orleans. That's an exciting place. As much as I loved Williamsburg, it was tame. You know, not that I was used to excitement in any case, because I'm from Virginia. But it was very romantic, and so I thought, yeah, I'll go down there. But they not only offered me a National Defense Fellowship, which paid me handsomely, but they also offered me a teaching fellowship. Jeez, you know, so I saved enough money out of my first 2 years of graduate school to go to Europe for about a month. I shouldn't brag about that now because people's experience with college loans is so incredibly painful. But that tells you about the shift in the public funding of education.
Yeah. So you... So it sounds like you went straight into grad school.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Summer, fall of 69, you land in New Orleans.
In my first car, a Volkswagen Bob.
So what was New Orleans like? How did it change you?
Oh, it was so hot. I drove down there in August because classes were going to start like in September. And as soon as I got down there, I went to the dormitory and I checked in and all that stuff. And I thought, I think I'll go down to the market. Well, this was August, like mid to late afternoon. And I literally got sick, nauseous from the heat. Because that little Volkswagen didn't have an air conditioner. Heavens, good grief. So anyway. So I wound up in a dormitory there, graduate dormitory, and I stayed there for 3+ years in that dormitory.
And what was the state of your sexuality or sexual identity at that time?
It improved.
At William & Mary, it was still...
I'll tell you how I came out.
Yeah.
there were one of the good jobs that students could get at William & Mary was with Colonial Williamsburg driving the tour buses. They paid well. It was a nice, comfortable job. And three of my friends that were all queer had rented an apartment, and I had finished for the summer at Tulane, and wanted to come back to Williamsburg because I had a lot of romantic feelings for Williamsburg, and stay with these guys that I liked a lot. And the first night I was there, my friend Stan said, "I got to go out and get some milk for us. Why don't you come ride with me?" I said, "Okay." On the way back, Stan says, "There's something I got to tell you. Mike, and I am queer." And that time, to hear the word queer was striking. Yeah. Now it's the acceptable term because it's more inclusive, but not at the time, you know. You advance when you said, "I'm gay." But it's okay. That was a very interesting, you know, confession. And it was like, wow, you know, I'm finally going to have some friends who are gay. But that wasn't my first thought. My first thought was, and my first things out of my mouth was, well, I've had some experiences in that direction, but I'm not going there. Big lie. And he says, "Oh, well, one of the two mics has a nice porn collection. He would want to show it to you." And I said, "Well..." So when the wall at work the next day, guess where I went? I went into those closets and looked for that collection and found it. Oh, boy. I never had such candy, you know?
There's so much there. I'm really surprised that he used the word queer.
I am too.
It was a slur, right? Derogatory.
It was a slur, and that's kind of where he was, or what he'd had to grapple with, you know.
And your response to him saying, "I have some experience, but," did that come from a place of that at that time, were all of your experiences the abusive ones, or had you started to have positive?
Well, I have to tell you that my experiences weren't. I wouldn't describe them as abusive. I had one guy, a man who worked for my father, who I would say when I was about 15 once tried to abuse me. And I said no. But those other experiences, the first guy, he was being abused, and he was simply replicating what he had learned, including passing on the same threats that his uncle was passing on him, he passed on to me. But I never thought of the experiences with those two guys as being abusive.
So was this when you talk about going back to William and Mary to see your friends, or back to Williamsburg to see your friends, was that your first summer back, do you know? Was that?
That was the first summer back. So it's only been a year since I left William and Mary,
So by 19, so my historian hat on here, right? So by 1970, you've had like the Gay Liberation Front and some of these groups out of Stonewall have started to come out, and there's some newsletters going around and stuff. Was that at all part of your friend's journey to coming out as queer, or was it something you were becoming aware of when you were at Tulane, that there was new groups or new publications coming out?
Yeah, I was a long-term and early subscriber to The Advocate, but I can't remember when I started that. I think it was after I had come back and taken the job at Ranford and had my own place that I started subscribing to that. And, you know, in New Orleans, there were, I can go into that history, but you know, you're looking for Roanoke. But New Orleans had been historically a queer city, a place where people from all over the South could come and feel somewhat safer to be out.
When you were in New Orleans, did you explore bars? Did you explore cruising?
I didn't explore. I know it's always been a bit of a coward, you know. I did do a lot of cruising. I would stare at guys. Oh, God, did I stare at guys, you know? But in terms of kind of learning out where you can pick up a guy, I wasn't into that because I simply lacked the courage or something. I don't know. But one night I remember that I had gone. One of the oldest bars in New Orleans was Lafitte's in Exile. It may even still be going. I think it started in the 40s. And it was famous for its triangular bar, you know, where you could, you could make a lot of contact, eye contact with the three sides. Yeah. And it was packed. It was a Saturday night. But it took me forever. I rode around and around and around in the French Quarter before I had the courage to park the car or even find a space. And go in there. It was more than an hour of getting my gumption up to go in. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I'm not going to tell you that story. It kind of worked out, but it was funny, awkward, you know.
Yeah.
But that was I think that was the one experience of going out. But there were guys, you know, in the dormitory. There were guys around me that were out. one of my professors at Tulane wasn't really out, but everyone knew he was gay. He was, you know, it was all right, and he would give me the wink, you know, and kind of let me know it's okay. But anyway.
Yeah. So you did your coursework and stuff at Tulane, and then your dissertation. But you say you were only there for 3 years.
Well, let's not make that dissertation so quick.
Okay.
I completed my coursework.
Yeah.
And then I made the classic mistake of graduate students. I hope you're listening. And this is that I selected a dissertation topic that was way too big to eat, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. And it was suggested to me by one of the best people and the most well-known people in the department, and it was an interest of his, and I didn't have any competing idea in my head about what my dissertation was going to be. So anyway, it was the topic was going to be on the sociology of the history of the sociology of religion. The sociology of science piece, mm-hmm. In which I would take all of the articles that dealt with religion in the major four major journals of sociology starting in 1895 and up to 1970, and develop an analysis questionnaire sheet to review them, and then looking for a variety of dimensions. And the most important dimension was this person who wrote the article a religious professional, and therefore in an institution that might be restricting what he could explore and what he could say, or what she could say, but it was mostly he's. And not surprisingly, well, you know, you can find a variety of things that would track with being a religious professional, including not really doing anything that was in any way critical of the institutions. It's too much to go into. I wound up doing 400 pages.
Wow.
Wow is right. And I don't think I've read that sucker since then, you know.
So tell me about leaving New Orleans. What was the next step? Did you start teaching somewhere?
The man I was doing my dissertation under took a position at the University of Virginia. They wanted him. So I went up there with him. You know, I was his underling, you know. So I went with him there. And, you know, they gave me some nighttime teaching to do. And I was there for a year and a half, and finally my mentor learned that there was this position opening up in Radford. And what was happening in the state of Virginia in 73 was that the state was giving a lot of money to the state colleges and universities to expand them because there were so many students, you know, post-war babies coming on the scene. So,
was Radford a co-ed at that time?
No. It had just gone co-ed. But it had been long. Historically, it had been a women's teaching college. So
you showed up at Radford.
Interviewed for the job. Got it.
Not out, I'm sure. When you applied for the job.
No. That was out of the question.
Yeah.
That was out of the question.
So you were in sociology department.
Yeah.
How long were you at Radford? Sounds like it was so big.
23 years. I didn't go looking.
Yeah.
I have to tell you that within the first few months of my being there, I was out. I was completely out as, you know, meet another gay person. Oh, I am too, blah, blah, blah. But not out to the department. But they all knew. You know, we don't hide much from folks, you know. Particularly if this is gayness is coming more into people's consciousness. And there was a very old woman in the department who described me, so I heard, as a well-known homosexual on campus. And, you know, I should have been fearful of something, but I wasn't. I laughed like you laughed. And So
tell me about starting to create a gay life in Southwest Virginia after you landed in Radford. Did you pretty soon hear about Roanoke, and was Roanoke drawing you?
I already knew. I already knew about the Trade Winds, which was the bar that was opened then, historically, supposedly one of the oldest in the state. And when I came down from Charlottesville to interview for the job, you know, I don't know what day of the week that was, but I made it to the Trade Winds. Stayed in Roanoke, made it to the Trade Winds. And, that was, you know, thinking back on it, how oppressive that was. But it was an openness that I wasn't accustomed to, much more openness than that. So,
what was it like, the Trade Winds? What was the crowd like? What do you remember?
Well, the first thing to know is, of course, you know, you already know that on the first floor of the Trade Winds, that was the ground floor, that was a restaurant where those two Italian brothers ran a restaurant. And I have a little thing to interject here. I just recently read some more history of the Italian experience in the United States, and you probably already know that there not only were blacks lynched, there were a good number of Italians who were lynched. You know, they were associated. They weren't white. They weren't white. And however, you know, the prejudiced mind interprets reality and filters it. They were seen to be not white. They were dark. So historically, supposedly, the bars in New York and any major city were run by Italians, and the explanation has always been, I think, that it's because of their connections to the mafia, maybe, you know, a little bit of prejudice there, and their link to the police because of the number of Italians who became police. But, okay, that's probably true. But I wonder how much of that openness to having gay bars was beyond just exploitation and something about being able to identify with other men who have been so rejected, men and women who have been so rejected. Mm.
Yeah, and we've heard that, we've heard people say, because they're all deceased, it's my understanding, that two of the three brothers who ran the place were assumedly gay.
I didn't know that.
That came up in other interviews. It's like, why did they run this place? Who knows? It's just hearsay. So you go down into the basement, through the back?
Yeah, I went to the back, and I went into the basement. Of course, going into the basement has its own connotations. If my father, though, one time my father was going to have a discussion with me about sex, and I won't go, no need to go into that, he said, "Won't you come with me down the basement?" Oh, jeez. Here we go. How about that association? But I went in there, and it was, I don't know, there weren't many people there. There were local folks, and I didn't know anyone, and I wasn't always the boldest about meeting people. But it was at least, it said to me that you can meet people here. Yeah.
So how did you start to find a gay community, a sense of community?
I also have to say that when I interviewed at Radford, I looked at the town of Radford, don't, please forgive me, and I said, no, I can't live here. I cannot live there. I mean, I was coming from New Orleans and from Charlottesville, and no, I couldn't do Radford. I took an apartment in Plattsburgh. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed I would probably meeting guys there. And I did, but I, you know, not being someone who's out cruising wherever the availability is, I met people mostly through, I think, going to Roanoke, to the bars.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I imagine in Blacksburg, there's a lot of tech people, Virginia Tech mostly.
Yeah, but they had their gay people too, you know.
Yeah.
Not everyone there was an engineer, and
That's stereotypical.
So did you live in Blacksburg then most of your 20-some years?
No. I lived there for several years, and then I had a boyfriend who was working for Norfolk and Southern. Yeah. He was a clerk, he's still alive, in the Norfolk and Western, Norfolk and Southern Railroad bureaucracy, there were no jobs for women, I don't think. All the clerks, read secretaries, were men. So I met him, and the question became, he had his own house here in Roanoke, and I was living in Blacksburg. So I finally decided that, why don't I buy a house that's halfway between us? And so, you know, I don't have so far to go. Or maybe he can, you know, come and live with me. And he did. We were together for 3 or 4 years. Mm.
And so tell me more about getting involved with Roanoke community. I'm assuming you met your boyfriend at the time in Roanoke. Mm-hmm. So were you going to other bars? Did you become aware of an activist group or community?
There was a lot of knowledge floating in the air. And I was meeting people, not necessarily to trick, but just meeting other gays in a variety of contexts. I can't recall a lot of the specifics. That was some millions of years ago.
Did you ever go down to here?
No, I didn't. I was aware of that, but I never actually. That wasn't me to be able to make that cruising.
Yeah, the cruising block here.
Yeah, that was a missed opportunity. You know?
There are a lot of stories.
I love Larry's
block. Yes.
Story about the looking down from the hotel.
Let me name some other bars or some of the discos. Did you go to the discos?
When we came in, we've been driving around town, we passed by The Last Straw.
Yeah.
And I had just a little gush of positive feelings. It's a church thing, I think. Unfortunately, my mind blanked that out. But I saw the building, and I was aware of that place. That came later, and you will know the specific date in which that came. But in terms of my history, what I recall is that there was the Trewins, which was not great, and I think The Last Straw developed. So, and I liked that a lot. It was a cozy place. It was so small that it forced people to be more open with one another and more outgoing, and it was fun. It was never a raunchy place. So none of the bars were. You know, there wasn't any. If you wanted to have backroom sex, you'd have to go to D.C., as far as I know, anyway.
Or not at the park.
I'm sure it happened, but I wasn't aware, you know. Good Virginia boy that I was.
Did you like the dance clubs, or did you prefer them?
I remember there was a place called Murphy's.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was... No, Murphy's was run by an older straight couple, I remember. But before that, there was a bar owned by several guys.
The Horoscope?
The Horoscope. Oh, that was when disco finally came to Roanoke. And they opened that dance bar. You weren't going to dance in the trade, but you weren't. Well, you could. I should tell you that story. There was. They opened that third store, that third floor up, at some point, and made it a dance place. Well, of course, the state of Virginia and all of its liberalism made it. Was it illegal for homosexuals to dance with one another? Yeah. And I recall being there on a Saturday night and looking around. And you can pick out, I knew nothing about the Vice Squad, but God, when you dress like you're going to a Baptist church and you're standing there in the middle of a queer place, you're going to stand out, boys, you know?
So these are police undercover.
Yeah, places. Yeah. And I thought, it made me angry. I wasn't fearful. It made me angry that they were there. And that was more and the more the reaction that people were feeling, gay people were feeling. You know, not just in New York City, but all over, I think. There was something welling up that we ain't going to take that anymore. So they didn't wind up arresting anyone, to my knowledge. But anyway. It's a lot of history here, so I get to...
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to hear about the Vice Squad, because we have some stuff we found about the police department and their efforts to entrap gay men. I mean, down here, the cruising... And they would pose as tricks or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's funny in your story because it sounds like they posed so poorly. No, if you're going to try to blend in.
No, because they were just looking for guys who were dancing. That alone was enough. They're not looking for guys who were picking up someone. They were looking for guys who were dancing. So they didn't need to be too... But people continued to dance in front of them, so I don't know what they were thinking and what they were up to. I'm sure you must have heard the rumor that was very active during the time of all of the particularly voracious police crackdowns on gay people in this city, was that the chief of police's daughter was lesbian. You heard that
No.
one? That, I tell you, that was the most active rumor about at the time. And he could not accept that.
This was 1970s-ish.
Early 70s, yeah. So, but I had a dean, my dean, the first time I was ever at a bar after I started teaching at Radford, a young girl, came up to me, because I think she was in the late teens, early 20s, and she identified herself as, she was the daughter of that dean. And I thought, oh my goodness, how should I take this? And so, but she was very out and very friendly, and, you know, talked about the struggles with her dad, but, you know, he wasn't going to throw her out, and but he knew, and... So never felt threatened by him, though I know that when I tried to hire Rick Troyden, he didn't get hired. And he was clearly the most impressive candidate of like several that we had to consider. And this dean made it a point to say to me, like, tell me that Troyden wasn't going to make it because, and he says, well, you understand why. Well, I think he was trying to say, well, Troyden was too out because he was doing his dissertation on this topic and was planning to write a book so that the university wasn't ready for that degree of openness.
Well, let me move forward in the conversation to the 1980s, so we've been looking at a lot of the Blue Ridge Lambda Press, the Pink Pages. Uh-huh. Your name is frequently in it. Particularly, there's an advertisement for your. Did you have a private practice of?
Well, we are coming ahead. Yeah,
counseling and stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is. Were you involved with the Blue Ridge Lambda Press people?
I knew, I have to say, and put this one on the record, that you've already interviewed him, but Jerry Jennings was the backbone of a lot of stuff that got accomplished in the gay community. My name might have been mentioned here and there as someone who was, that's because I was very out, and I was outspoken, and I had a professional position, and therefore my voice had more weight, maybe, than some other places, other people's. And but I was not good at organizing, and I was not did not really contribute that much. I did my job of being outspoken, but I was two points. I was particularly outspoken, and that is, we had Mary Bankey, you know, from Parents PFLAG, and my friend Allison. You've got to interview her. The two of us and Sam Garrison and Jerry Jennings, I think, went to have a conversation with the mayor. And he was not a friend of our community.
We can talk about public officials, son.
Oh, we can? Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. He was not a friend of the gay community. Yeah. And there was, I forget, you know, you forget the sequence of things, but there was the issue of amending the city's, whatever, ordinances, so that gay people would not be discriminated in city
employment.
And that was on the table. We had gotten that on the table. So there was a meeting, I don't know where it was. There was a council, city council candidates were there, and it was an open forum to ask them questions. Well, there was like about 9 or 10 of the active gay people in town who were there. And I say that I wasn't very involved, but, you know, sometimes I was the one who had the guts to say something, and I had the big mouth to speak. And so I stood up and I made sure that that was a very open agenda, and that the gay community was very eager to have the support of city council. And it didn't happen that right away, but it, in time, but that's a process. So
I've heard about that forum. I think it was 1990.
Okay.
Is that right?
there was another time. It might have been at that same forum when all of a sudden I had a mic put in front of my face, and the guy was interviewing me. Been told that I would speak up for one of the channels here, and you know, I said what I had to say, and went home. And my partner at the time and I turned on the TV, and there was this interview. And it starts out, Maya Reed is gay. Why don't you say these things quietly, dear?
On television.
Yeah. I wasn't ready for that. I thought, oh, bye. But it's okay. Everyone knew. It was all right for me to do that. It had no repercussions.
Did you have tenure, and did that make you feel protected?
I did have tenure. I started out as an assistant professor, and then I pretty quickly got associate. It wasn't too long before I was full, and there wasn't a lot of. If there was whispering in the background, I don't think it was allowed to get anywhere, you know, so.
Let me ask you about HIV and AIDS.
Yes.
That was becoming a bigger concern in the 80s at that same time.
Yeah.
What was Roanoke like? What was the world of that here?
Well, I have to take a breath, because as you well know, that was like, all of a sudden, this very dark cloud descends. And yes, we heard about the gay cancer, and we heard about it in San Francisco and New York, but then we heard about it in D.C. And you know, D.C. was a favorite place for gay men who wanted to have a bigger playground to go on the weekends, you know. The Lost and Found was the most popular bar, but then there were the baths, and, you know, that. It was a time of great liberation for gay men, and we were feeling our oats. And to have that bastard of a disease come into our party was just, I mean, if I had any thought of resisting doing this interview, it was us getting to that point, because it's stepping back into a time it's just hard for anyone in that time to tell you what that's like, although you probably know something of it. But we started having friends, and I mean, I'm telling you, it wasn't just one friend, and then all of us, it was like a flock of us dropping. It was nothing like what the guys in D.C. or San Francisco were experiencing, like everyone they knew was ill, but I was living in Old Southwest. I had moved from the house that I had bought before up in Shawsville, that's a different story, to come in here, and Old Southwest was like a little gay ghetto. Hey, yay, we're almost in a big city, you know. It's, you know, gay neighbors. Wow, isn't that strange and different and wonderful? This was a liberated zone. So we were concentrated. A lot of the folks were concentrated there. And they just... too much. Can we stop? Sorry. I have a name to mention.
Maybe yeah. We don't want to break it.
Okay, yeah. I'll tell you the name later. A guy who I still maintain contact with because he's on Facebook. It's where all the old folks are. And he could tell you a lot. His partner he was such a sweet man. And he was active. His name was Curtis. And Curtis was one of the first. There were some very popular guys that were very handsome, you know, who we all either had sex with or wanted to have sex with at some point, and they... getting going. If you, of course, these things became clearer very quickly that if you had been in quote unquote a passive favorite of being a bottom, you know, all the terms we use, you had much greater risk. So, none of that was coherent, but I hope the emotion is there.
It was. No, it was coherent. How do you feel like that the AIDS crisis changed you or changed the community? People's behaviors changed, or were you involved with any of the local AIDS advocacy stuff?
I was asked. There was a woman who's a clinical psychologist at the VA system, and the VA system got the first AIDS patients here. They were mostly guys who'd been involved in the military and came back. Or they would maybe got them because there was a physician at the VA who early on began to specialize and became really the major spokesperson for a medical community on how to deal with AIDS. And this clinical psychologist was at the VA. She called me one day, and I haven't told you how I developed my practice.
Yeah.
But I had a counseling practice. And so I went to... she called me and she told me that there was a need to have a support group run, and she would like to have my help in doing that. as an out gay man, and she was a straight woman, and so she wanted me to help. And of course, the first thought in my body was run away. But what can I do? I had to say, oh, yes, I will. And I don't know how long we ran that, a couple of years maybe, a little bit more. For a period of time, they met at my house because there was nowhere else to meet. But then there were a number of the guys who were uncomfortable meeting in my house, and I understand that. So somehow an alternative was developed. I really don't know what we did at that point. But it had gotten beyond the point where there were like three or four or five or seven guys there, you know, that the community was having much more of a problem issue with AIDS.
Do you remember if this group had a name? Were you called something? Or it was just sort of an undercurrent?
I think the AIDS support group, there was nothing formal to it at all. Yeah.
And it was in Old Southwest in your apartment there, or your house?
No. Oh, heavens. I went through. We're talking about gays in their 20s and 30s at that time. You know, we were changing the world by remodeling every available house. So I had three of them that I remodeled, and I was out on Lake Drive at that point in time. Do you have any idea what that is? Behind Lewis Gale Hospital. Uh-huh. There's one of the first suburbs ever to be developed in Roanoke was out in that direction, and they built these lakes. There are three lakes out there, which were meant to draw people way out into the country like that. So they put these houses around these attractive lakes where they could go rowing in their boats with their children, you know. So I found a house out there, loved it. It was mid-century modern before that term was being used. And it had been owned by a local TV personality here in the 50s called Uncle Looney.
Never heard.
Oh, no, you wouldn't have. You asked somebody who was here in the 50s. Everyone knew Uncle Looney. And we found wigs and stuff left behind by Uncle Looney.
So that's where you had the AIDS support group?
Mm-hmm. Which wasn't convenient for everyone, you know, but damn, that's what we had. That's what I could offer.
Yeah.
The counseling, what happened there is... Yeah. When I started getting more seriously involved in relationships, I realized I lacked some skills, or I needed something, some help. So that was the first time that I went into therapy for myself. And turns out I wound up seeing this man that I'm still in contact with today. He was the head of the family therapy program at Virginia Tech. And the family therapy program there was very good. So when I got through doing that, seeing through counseling with him, I decided, I'm going to get training in family therapy because it fits very naturally with sociology. Jim was very welcoming of me, and over a period of about 4 years, I went, jumped through all the hoops, took the classes, did this, that, and the other, got the outside training, to get licensed. At that time, there was no family therapy license. There has been for the last 10 years, I think, or so. But it was licensed professional counselor, which is what you became. So I did that. And so that's why I had that practice, and that's why that ad was in the paper. But I never, this has always been, was done in addition to never dropping a thing at Rapid, yeah.
I wonder if, did you attract LGBT clients to your practice? I wonder
That was a large part of it. And there were other counselors who knew that I was gay, and so they might refer people to me. But there were, you know, just those ads and you know, gossip in the community, whatever. And most of the issues, you know what people would come for. They came mainly for the relationship with their families and the rejection that they were already experiencing or fearing rejection if and when they came out. So sometimes it was couples, you know, a kind of a marriage therapy thing.
Sounds like you might have been the first licensed counselor to be there for LGBT people who needed that here. Does that sound right?
I think I can say that. There were a couple others that came along and are still here and, you know, do great jobs. When I first, my mentor in the family therapy program, had a gay son. I didn't know it at the time. He had a gay son. So he had had some familiarity with dealing with gays in his family. And that was helpful to have that. But there were people I encountered, not necessarily Virginia Tech, but elsewhere when I kind of got involved in family therapy things. who were really bothered by the idea of someone who was gay being involved in family therapy. What would you know about families? Excuse me. Didn't grow up like Topsy, you know?
Yeah. So we're at about an hour that we've been talking.
Not hard for me to cover in an hour.
Yeah, and so I wonder if we can talk about leaving Roanoke, when you left Roanoke, and just what are some of the later stages of your life so far that you've experienced, and how it shaped your identity as a gay man?
It's a broad question. Well, the state offered a buyout when I was 50 years old. The state offered a buyout, and it was a new trend that was beginning across corporations and in state offices, and it was, let's get rid of the more expensive, older, in case of academia, tenured, you know, faculty, and let's hire new. new all but dissertation graduate students, and pay them much less, and not worry about tenure. So the state offered the buyout, and I was, that was in October, I think it was, and I didn't debate it long. I was really so ready. I was so ready. I had some income from the therapy program practice, not much. And I had been doing my hobby, in addition to all of this stuff in my free time, was antiquing. And I had developed a business in antiques on the side. And I had decent income from that. So I knew that I could make it somehow. And I was tired of doing what I was doing. So I took it. And it was an eventful year. It was at the same time, that was in April. I was set up to about mid-April to teach my last classes. And about 2-3 weeks before classes were to end, my father died. And that was a really difficult thing because I'd always had, like any gay man or any gay woman, a difficult time in my relationship with my father. And he was the, my mother wanted to disown me. She did. And he prevented it. And something I find very curious is I knew that a primary support for my mother was our pastor at the little country church that they went to. And my mother was a forceful person. And I know she was bending his ear about her son being queer and wanting support for all of her hostilities. And as I learned later, that man, that pastor, within about 2 years after my father died and all that was going on with my mother, came out. He had 3 daughters, young kids, and he came out. And I had so much anger towards him because, I'm a bitch for, supporting her in her hatreds. But good God, he was a country minister. And little did I know, I could look at the man and I could tell you, sorry, forgive my prejudice, but you're queer. but I didn't. I couldn't. But that's what happened. And he somewhere on the earth, and last I heard, he had a partner. Well, bless his heart. That's good. That's good. That's good. I know you have had your karma. Don't worry about it. You've had your karma already. So my father died. And I went down for the funeral. That was in South Hill, La Crosse. And the first night I was there, I had a heart attack. The next morning, I had a heart attack.
Talk about events. My sister, who was in the habit of calling the rescue squad regularly for my father, because he had so many ailments towards the end of his life. So she paid no attention to me, and she called them, bless her heart. She called them. There I was, at a crucial moment, they gave me a new drug that would block up the blockage, break up the blockage, and I made it through that. And the next couple of days, they sent me to Richmond for advanced care, whatever. So I've not had another one. I've had some cardiac procedures done since then, just to keep the thing clean. But that was a hell of a lot happening. And within 2 weeks, I just coasted out that semester.
I don't think I went back and maybe I taught a few classes, yeah. But I was not fit for anything. sorry to end on that note, but that's kind of what happened. And then I realized that as I was recovering from that, and that took less time than one would think. My partner and I at that time had been going to Phoenix for professional reasons, for my professional reasons. I was going to psychotherapy conferences out there. But we also loved being out in Arizona. So in February, after that April ending of my career, I decided I went back to Phoenix and was enjoying having a good time and thinking. And then I was at a gay bed and breakfast, and there was a friend of the owner there who knew about, he was a realtor. So I made the mistake, opened my big mouth, and said, "How's housing cost here?" Well, here we go. We're off to the races. You don't ask a question like that to a realtor. So he showed me around town. So I called my partner then, and I said, "I think we're going to be moving out here, and I think I found a house." That was a tough guy to live with. You would get bombshells like that. Of course, I had no intention of doing it without it, unless he was going to be joining me. But he was had a CPA,
And there was some small CBA firm he was working for here, and he was openly gay as well, and he was a little fearful. He was really a bright fellow, and he really needed a bigger pond to swim in professionally. Mm. So he was gung-ho. It was very unnerving for him. Mm. Are we out of time?
No, it's just the sirens that are apparently really loud.
That should have happened when I was mentioning my heart attack.
So that was late 90s, when you left?
97 is when we moved to Phoenix. And I've been there now for 19 years, and I think I've done the math. And it's, we like it a lot. It's hell come July and August, it's hell. And my partner and I, now and the current partner then and I split maybe 7 years after we got there. Hope no one's adding this all up. And I met Bill, and we've been together for 15 years, married for 5. So.
Is there anything else you want to make sure that we know about Southwest Virginia and...
Oh, I think one thing that I've not seen mentioned, maybe someone has, it wasn't earth-shattering, but it was a little sign of an attempt to create a more decent life for gays. And that was John and I and another couple, long living in Florida, were... created something called, I think, the Gay Supper Club. It was never very formally, you know. We would run a little ad in the Blue Ridge Land Press or something like that, I think. I don't recall. But the whole point was we would contract with a restaurant to open up the restaurant just for gay people. And that was an effort to find restaurants that would open up for gay people, you know. And but I tell you, more times than not, it was minority owners, the Brazilians and Chinese and Japanese, that opened their doors. And they were good business people. They could say, hey, that's a group we wouldn't mind having spending money here. And so, you know, anyone, it was both men and women, and anyone who wanted to come, and I think, I don't know, it was a set fee. So we had to, you know, that excludes a lot of folks who can't afford that set fee. But it was like, I don't know, a meal for $15, a dinner for $15, and they were buffets. I don't know, I'm not clear about the prices and everything. But it was, you know, as long as you made a little bit of income, you could afford it. And that went well for a period of time. We didn't have any of them that fizzled out. You know, there would be 20, 30, 40 or more people. Yeah. It felt good to do that.
Was this in the 80s, 90s?
I'm going to say late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. And you need to check that fact with some other folks who were involved. You know, it's like
we
anything.
We can check the Blue Ridge Land.
Yeah. And people, there were, you know, we started it, but yeah, and, you know, after a while, you know, other people get on board and help. And I can't remember who that league of people were, but the community got it going, which was good.
Anything else you want to share about this region?
I'll call you later.
Okay.
It's another 5 hours worth.
Well, it was so wonderful to have the opportunity to do this interview with you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.